Good morning, friends, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are just one of over two dozen similar lodges throughout the country, but we are all bound by one overall idea, and that is service to humanity, universal brotherhood. And to that extent, the lodge here in Philadelphia does have two regularly scheduled meetings. On Sunday, as we are gathered together now, the doors open at 10:30. The meeting starts at 11 and runs until 12. This year so far, we have been looking at comparative religions for February and for March. For March, the overall topic in those comparative religions is service to others. And we have, these meetings for this month are going to be panel discussions in regards to what the mainstream, so to speak, religions believe in regards to spiritual growth, and then we'll be having the theosophical approach to it. On Wednesdays, our doors open from at 5:30. We have our library open from 5:30 until 7:30. Our meeting starts, and we are looking at the ocean of theosophy, and that is the study guide that we're going to be using for this spring. And we're looking at the after-death states. Mm-hmm. And the meeting runs from quarter of eight until nine. And when the library is open from 5:30 until 7:30, it's a reference library. The reference for that night's class is available, as well as the reading that we're going to be going over as a group study. The lodge is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions, as well as we are all volunteers that keep this lodge going. Those of us on the platform are all volunteers. So if you are interested in helping in any little way, you can see the person who is at the book table. We are having on March 21st a special meeting on Wednesday, March 21st, a great theosophist, William Q. Judge. And this meeting is run a little bit differently. We'll be looking at the life of Mr. Judge and his contributions to the philosophy. So it's we look at it as being a meditative meeting, and if we ask people to come a few minutes ahead of time to kind of get into the mood for the meeting. So our meeting today, we're going to be, as we said, it's service to others, comparative religions. And we are going to be looking at the ideas of renunciation and detachment. So, which is, when we're thinking of religion, if we're looking at philosophies, most of the time we don't really think of how renouncing and detaching have to do with it. And then when we look at it, it's like, which came first, renouncing or detachment? So we'll be looking at a lot of different aspects. This first talk, will be looking at the traditional religions and their idea of how renouncing and detaching have to do with somebody's spiritual growth. And then the second speaker will do the theosophical ideas about it, and then we'll open up to questions and discussions. So when we're looking at this idea then of what to renounce and how to detach, what these philosophies and religions are looking at is, what is it that we need to renounce? Do we need to renounce anything? And how does detachment fit into that? There are many, as we all know, there are many distractions in today's world. They're looking at the ideas of sin, of evil, financial distractions. Just, there's so much out in the world today that it taking our, you know, our looking at ourselves, bringing it outward. And we are not able to center and to actually think about our true natures. And because of this, we're looking at the idea that it is exceedingly difficult to reach God. And this God is an outward God. So that these distractions and these ideas are preventing us from looking outward from what these religions are saying. And that the desires of the body cause even our good motives and desires to become distorted and confused. And what theosophy would say is our lower nature, they're looking at the idea of the ego, not the ego, but the ego is getting into our way with that true relationship to God. And they're saying that through self-denial and separation from everything tempting and attractive about the world, the soul is purified. And that's a definite red light to us when we're saying that, why would the soul have to be purified? And that when the soul becomes empty of ego, does it then become a vessel suitable to be filled by God? So this is basically the whole idea of the religions that are looking towards an outside God to become holy, so to speak. So when we're looking at the idea of renouncing, the idea then is, how does one overcome this attachment that is had to these distractions that are all around us and these selfish desires, and it obscures the person's ability to reach up to God. In the Christian perspective, it is a way to recover the true self, which is loving and compassionate, having been created in the image of God. Judaism would say, the Torah abides only with him who regards himself as nothing. And in Galatians, in the Bible, it says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. So to continue on in regards to renunciation, it would be said in some of the other religions that a person must put God first. An attachment to riches is an obstacle to realization of the spiritual goal. So once again, the idea is looking outward for this spiritual goal, and that whatever is going on in today's life well, we know, we don't need to go into specifics, there's a lot going on out there. And but so much of it is pulling the attention away from that true spirituality. And it is said that it is today's life that is preventing a person from reaching out and making that contact with their God. So again, with Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy for Judaism and Christianity, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So whatever is going on in someone's life, they're not hearing that outside movement, so to speak. So this is a familiar quote from Matthew. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. And then from Corinthians, I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried woman or virgin is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. And so then too, in regards to separation, you know, from family duties also takes people away from their communing with their God. And some scriptures describe family ties as attachments, and which partake of illusion, which are to be overcome in order to achieve tranquility, enlightenment, and the highest goal. But they're saying again that it's the whole distraction idea just permeates this, you know, this whole talk, because it is the attachment that people are looking at from themselves that is preventing them from reaching out to God. So when we're looking at this idea of detachment, then it is detaching from what is going on in one's life. We can start out by renouncing it and then actually mentally pulling back from those distractions, but then it's not an inward experience that is happening. It's an outward reaching for God. And again, from Judaism and Christianity in Micah, put no trust in a neighbor, have no confidence in a friend, guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your bosom. For the son treats the father with contempt, the daughter rises up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house. But as for me, I will look to the Lord. I will wait for the Lord, for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. So it just goes, it just kind of permeates, you know, the whole thought that we have to reach out. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And that's from Luke. Um, And then when we're looking at the idea of detaching, he lives detached from worldly thoughts and sense impressions. And that's the whole idea of the thought to clear one's mind, make it empty, so that one can reach out to God and be filled that way. This is from Romans. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And then the Unification Church. What is the path of the word? It is that a person gives up his desire for the world and has a deep yearning for God's world. We should love God's world more than we love any person, parents, children, or spouse. And just to end, we found some wonderful ideas. If people are familiar with Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, he came up with this idea. He was a psychiatrist he was Jewish in the concentration camps during World War II. And his whole thing that he came up with was in his mind, it almost sounded like an attachment to something that was going to pull them forth, to get away from, mentally away from the horrors of being in the camp. But he also wrote a wonderful idea on renouncing. And we know it's not kind of part of what our talk is, but we just thought it was a wonderful way for us to end my part. Don't aim at success. The more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you are going to miss it. For success, like happiness, cannot be pursued. It must be ensued. And it only does so as the unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a cause greater than oneself, or as the byproduct of one's surrender to a person other than oneself. Happiness must happen, and the same holds for success. You have to let it happen by not caring about it. I want you to listen to what your conscience commands you to do and go on to carry it out to the best of your knowledge. Then you will live to see that in the long run, I say, success will follow you precisely because you had forgotten to think about it. So in a way, initially it kind of sounds like he's talking about, becoming attached to the end in view. But then at the end, he does say that if you can become detached from the issues at hand.
These questions, we always get it mixed up. What to renounce, how to detach. These questions can be found posed by Arjuna to Krishna 5,000 years ago. And if we really look at his questions and Krishna's answers, Krishna representing not an outside being, but one's own higher nature. In other words, if we turn our questions within, if we look to the highest, whether we find it inside ourselves or we find it in the spiritual words of those that we know are wise. Arjuna, after 4 chapters of discussion that go back and forth about renunciation and detachment, says, "At one time, O Krishna, thou praisest the renunciation of action, and yet again its right performance. Tell me with certainty Which of the two is better? Krishna goes on to explain that they will both lead to the same end. But the problem is, if you renounce in the way of what's called the Sankhya philosophy, which means do nothing, because it might cause you difficult karma. So just be quiet, calm, and meditative, and do nothing. That leads to errors and problems and selfishness. That the real way to renunciation is through action. To attain to true renunciation of action without devotion through action is difficult. The man of purified heart, having his body fully controlled, his senses restrained, and for whom the only self is the self of all creatures, is not tainted, although performing actions. And then he goes on to describe the illuminated one, seeing all things as one and the same, from the lowest to the highest. He who, while living in this world, and before the liberation of the soul from the body, can resist the impulse from desire and anger, is a devotee and blessed. The man who is happy within himself, who is illuminated within, is a devotee and partaketh of the nature of the Supreme Spirit. Lofty. But what are we supposed to do with it? We're here in the here and now and don't seem to be having a dialogue with Krishna, although we would be reminded by the philosophy that we usually are. We hear promptings from our own higher nature and talk ourselves out of it. You know, whatever it is, being kind to someone or doing the task in front of us, we often disagree with that and go on to do what we wanted to do in the first place. The difficulty with renunciation is the interpretation that we put on it. And in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, the meaning of the teacher, Krishna, has been by some suggested to be almost impossible for the majority of men, so it is wiser to perform good acts in the hope that in the future we will be able to lead the kind of renunciation life. I think such is not the meaning, but the seemingly easy alternative of performing actions properly is in reality the most difficult of all tasks. So, what does that mean? What is so difficult about renunciation and action combined? Well, the difficulty is what we're being asked to renounce is our own selfish interest in the results of our action. In other words, instead of acting because it will benefit me, bring me praise or money or attention, whatever it is, instead of that, we renounce that attachment. We act because it is what has come to us to be done, whether at work or within family, whatever it is, we act and give up our interest in the result. In other words, success or failure mean nothing because, first of all, they're not in our control. Someone else labels things success or failure. All we can do is our best with what's in front of us to be done. And in that struggle, because it is a struggle, we're not used to behaving this way. It's very anti-American. It's very anti-West. It's very anti-individual. We're supposed to be competitive, we think. We're supposed to scratch our way forward over the heads of everybody else. So it's a strange notion to act on the basis of what you have to do and not what it will bring me as a result. And it is a gradual process of renunciation. What do we detach then? Well, obviously we detach our feelings from our actions, but the most important thing to realize is all action is the result of thought. You cannot act without a thought underlying it. And that is where the detachment begins, in thought. We are trying to clean up our own thinking, to challenge the ideas we have, and to attach ourselves, where we can, to higher ideas, starting, of course, with that primary one, universal brotherhood. We have to recognize that we are not separate, although that appears to be the reality, that we are one with all of life, that we are all here for a purpose, and that in reality, the wisest being we can imagine, whether it's Krishna or Buddha, Christ, is no different from any one of us. Any one of us, the lowest human you can imagine, is no different from a Krishna, Buddha, or Christ. The difference is in awareness, in development, in degree of recognition of his or her own nature. Buddha said it best. Look within, thou art Buddha. So we have to detach from all the ideas that pull us down and pull us apart and begin to attach to those higher ideas. We will, by looking kindly, looking graciously at other religions, we will see that it's there, just under the cover sometimes. We think the best example in Christianity, we're told, we just lost the first part of it, but it's, the Lord is not mocked. Theosophy says, when you read in the Christian Bible, the Lord, substitute the law. In other words, karma is not mocked. As ye sow, ye shall reap. It is law. So we have to look in the things we know, we think we know already, find those hints and challenges in other religions, see those statements for what they really are, a distortion on these ancient truths, that we have to renounce our selfishness and act from the best we can at that moment. It may not be that great, but it's the best we have at that moment. And detach ourselves from our personal feelings and look to the higher. Now, we're sure you have questions. Yes? Yes.
We're thinking as you're discussing this, both sides of the track, I would say, we just sort of wonder what happens to an individual who's been brought up with a background that they're just a poor, miserable sinner, and this is it, this one life, so you better get all you can. Those sort of help with this idea of looking outside rather than even thinking of looking inside.
Well, your question is what happens to such an individual? Well, of course, it depends on their motive, where their heart is set. We know many dogmatic Christians who are better theosophists than students of theosophy because they have within their hearts that warmth and generosity. They may look outside to a God, but at the same time, they follow the scripture that we should be loving and giving to each other. So we don't think we can judge, but remember, look at yourself. Where were you 10, 20, 30 years ago? What did you think? What ideas did you hold? How are you suddenly approaching these higher ideas? So no one is left out.
We're all on the same path, but we're going different ways. So everybody is at a different level. Everybody is at a different spot in their own spiritual journey. So the person who believes in the one life, as was said, they could be a very warm, caring person. Or to go to the other extent, that person might be very fearful, may want to get everything they can because this is the only life, I'm going to make my mark, and not be a caring individual. So the range of lives along that path is very varied, and we would think each person is different from the next, that kind of idea.
And remember, just because someone lives that way, in a selfish or greedy way, it doesn't put them beyond the pale. We never stop being spiritual beings, which means that we will reap the result of the mess we made and be given opportunities to fix things. That's what karma is, an obstacle that is an opportunity for you to learn from the results you have created. It's not, there is no final failure, there is no final victory. So even the worst of us can grow over time.
We think one of the hardest things is to act with the best motive we can and then to leave the results to the law. We have, in the attachment to the action, we want to have control over the result or expect a certain reaction, and we think it's really difficult to do those couple of words, leave the results to the law. We think it's a step that is, you know, right now out of reach for some of us, but very, very important.
Well, we think one of the things we have to do is be logical. Whether you want to control it or not, you can't. Can you make the sun come up tomorrow? No. Can you direct the weather? Can you do any of these things? Can you make someone love you? Can you make someone stop picking on you? No, you can't do any of those things. All you can worry about is how you deal with those things. Oh, it's all cloudy and the sun, I'm not going to see any sun. And oh, my boss is mean to me. So what? All of these things are just opportunities for growth. So whether we realize it or not, we never have had any control over results. But we think what's really being said is, when I do something, I want it to turn out the way I want it to turn out, which is ignorant on our part. You can't learn from things if you already have that attitude. How do we learn? We learn by watching our reaction. We do something and it doesn't turn out the way we wanted. We can learn more about ourselves from the feelings we get. Let's say we do something nice for somebody, and then the next day we realize, they never even said thank you. They didn't do anything for me. And this attitude you begin to recognize as something awful and ugly. Well, if we were to follow what's given to us in many religions, it would be deny that, throw it away. But that isn't the way it works. We have to understand it. Why do I feel this way? Where does it come from? I will watch myself and I'll learn about this seed of selfishness in me. So it's by degrees we become more intelligent about ourselves.
Viktor Frankl says, when we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. So if we put something out there and, as was said, we don't have control over how it's going to be received, and some people, you do something for them, and for them, it's an expectation that you should have done it anyway. So, you know, because it's out there, because it's there to be done. And he also says, everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, mm-hmm. to choose one's own way. But we have to have that awareness, that we have to have the awareness of the law, so that we know that we can put out the action, but how it's going to be received, how it's going to end. Once we start that motion, we're done with it. Yes.
In the first talk, two of the quotes were from Luke and the Unification Church, and they both seemed similar in that it had to do with renouncing your family, your friends, everything else, giving it up, and then following the Lord. And then we were thinking Viktor Frankl in the concentration camp. We've read about the experience, but of course he lived through it. And it would seem on one level that, you know, you do need to renounce everything and find a center, but that's only, I mean, that can't be the whole picture, because that would be selfishness. So those quotes seem really awfully selfish.
But you find that even in the Gita, there's a necessity of standing alone without depending on the love, affection, attention of anyone else, and then the opposite, which is expanding your awareness to the realization that you really are one with everyone else.
Right, but so that's you're, in the Gita.
But that's the same thing. It tells you that kind of stepping away, separating, but at the same time, you have to take it another step. It depersonalizes it. But it's something that we all will have to do at some stage. Depend on no one and nothing.
And theosophy would say as well that we are born into a family. We are born into a city, a nation, the world, because there are objectives that we have to meet along our own spiritual path. And we think the detachment at that point is, as was said, an individual attachment, a pulling away from the results of the actions that you are creating in your interactions with people, not expecting results, living in this world but not of it, we think is an absolutely beautiful statement to describe what this whole process would be. That some of the religions are talking about actually physically leaving your family, your friends, your obligations. But theosophy would say you're here for a purpose, and your duty is where you are, and to learn how to do it by not getting emotionally involved with how other people are reacting.
But then there's also in the tradition that we find in the Gita, there is that point at which the soul, wanting to go on further on the path of wisdom, must go to every member of his or her family and say, is it all right with you if I separate from this and focus on wisdom? And if any one family member says, no, I still need you, that soul does not move on at that point.
Sometimes, if one is in a situation where they're in an active addiction to whatever, but it's destroying their life, and their family and friends are also in that addiction, they do need to leave them if they're going to recover. You know, ideally, they'll get enough strength to be able to be an example and to help.
We think that's a very challenging question.
Yeah.
To make that judgment. We think, especially, it is a judgment.
Yeah.
Because you have to make a judgment about when to leave. And that's hard, especially if there's deep affection between people. You're calling on people, aren't you?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We were thinking that when we follow the law of karma and are serious about our spiritual growth and development, we stop thinking about the things that come to us as something that we should make a decision on as to whether I like it or whether I don't like it or where it came from. Because today we find so often that family and friends and community and whatever are really all the same. So in standing alone but not feeling separate, it helps us to deal with all of these forces that are coming from so many different places, because these forces are the results of causes we have set up in past lives. So we don't make a distinction between this or that. We simply accept what comes and grow from it and gain strength.
Yes, and that helps one to detach from the situation as well. Because it's interesting, because two people can be together, and one just has this overwhelming need to make sure that they have this person's approval, whatever, that there's an emotional attachment. And then if that person learns to detach from the, it looks as if the same thing's going on. It's a mental pulling away. One doesn't necessarily have to leave, although there does come a time when that does need, if somebody's, you know, moving forward. But there is, as was just said, that's an excellent way to learn how to detach from another person.
I think he had a question.
Well, there's a quote from the voice that says, make pride and self-regard bond maidens to devotion. So what are we to be devoted to? Our own progress, our own spiritual progress, or the progress of everyone, like Kuan Yin? And how do we purify our nature so that those godlike qualities are able to manifest here?
Well, at our point where we are right now, if we were to literally take the Kuan Yin pledge that we're alive and active and in service for the good of all, we're going to fall on our face, because we can't get along with family members. We can't get along with the clerk in the drugstore. We can't begin anywhere but where we find ourselves. So we have to say, okay, I'm going to be devoted to trying to be a soul in evolution. I'm going to watch what I say and what I do, and I'm going to learn from it. I'm not going to ignore it, deny it, pretend it isn't there. I'm going to be a scientist. I am a mind in evolution. I can watch and learn and observe. Certainly, I do it with everybody else. I can say why this person does that and why this person does that. I may be totally wrong, but I don't do it for myself. So I can begin to make my pride and self-regard, how well will I behave like a scientist in watching this nature of mine in action, realizing the whole time that I am the mind being that allows it to behave the way it does.
Yes.
And no one can or has the right to judge another. Mm-hmm. Because, as is said, walk a mile in the other's shoes. No matter what the outward appearance is, We are all struggling day to day, moment to moment, to do what's being described in today's talk. And instead of judging, perhaps we can lend a hand or notice, you know, you seem very peaceful today. How did you do that? What's on your mind? Give some kind of constructive rather than destructive comment.
Yeah. Well, we were thinking how quickly we jump to conclusions about people. Mm-hmm. We start, perhaps, with their physical appearance. We recall one of the students working around the time of HPB was very annoyed because this very dirty man came, you know, barefoot and ugly clothes, and he rejected him. He wouldn't let him in his home. And he found out later that it was a very high disciple who couldn't care less about the appearance. But we do. We judge people by their appearance, by their accent, by their education, by their background. And we're wrong. We have to become charitable and open to learning, to literally meeting someone on the basis of souls. We miss many an opportunity mm-hmm. to be educated.
Yes.
It really is a twofold thing. Well, in order to be there for others, we have to grow as individuals and develop our individuality, because if we don't, we might spend ourselves it is necessary to both.
Yes.
We have to become, I have to become me.
Well, if
at
you
the
think,
same time, I can give of myself.
Right. Someone said it before you go helping another, clean your own doorstep. So it is a twofold process. We have to work on our own character and nature, but the purpose of it is devotion. Devotion to the good of all humanity, even though we can't work at that range yet.
Yeah, we have another wonderful quote from Viktor Frankl. It says, ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. So, and he's talking about duty, and basically that's what we've been talking about all morning so far, is doing our duty as it comes right. to us.
And in 2 weeks, that will be the very subject of this panel.
Come back
and hear more. You can never get away from duty. As Mr. Judge says, it's the royal talisman. Do what is in front of you to do, and do it with your whole heart without looking for a reward. But the Frankl, of course, in surviving the concentration camp, wanted to know why he survived and those who were in the camp with him. And he realized it was the will to be present and to care about the people around you. The ones who survived were the ones who were looking out for other people, not just themselves.
So it seems that the common thread is suffering, because renunciation, you are suffering, because the personal is sacrificing to the impersonal. So is that what this is all about, suffering and realizing who we are?
Well, we would like to know one thing, just one, that can be achieved without suffering. Even a small child doesn't get up and walk without suffering stretching muscles and making things grow and change. Everything is suffering in the sense that you have to make things, substance or feelings, move so that you can have them where you want them, how you want them. The problem isn't suffering. The problem is, with all the suffering we have already been through, we've made a big mess. If you ever want to have a fascinating study, look at how much of the water in the world is potable. How much of it? It's something like 1% or something. And where is it? It's in our dishwashers, in our swimming pools. It isn't in places where there are children dying from lack of hydration, where women have to walk 5 miles to a well and then 5 miles back to bring the water. So everything is suffering. We just don't realize here the suffering that we're creating for others and for ourselves because we are ignoring the suffering of the world.
And then it's just a short comment, and then it's one's attitude towards that suffering. Are we acknowledging it, that it is how we can grow and learn, or is it something that we're, you know, poor me kind of thing? Yes?
It's true that renunciation can bring suffering, will bring suffering. Some of the suffering is not because we've renounced something, but if we, like your comment, renunciation may bring suffering, but in the end, it brings release and freedom, because of whatever you renounce is something that's been holding you back. And if you can give it up and let go of it, you have that wonderful sense of freedom from it.
Yes, we're like birds who've forgotten we have wings. We're trapped where we parked ourselves.
Yes, in the back.
In a lot of the religions, there are practices that help us build that endurance. Right now in the Christian kingdom, we're in the season of Lent, where you consciously give something up, sacrifice something that is dear to you for a period of time. Deny it to yourself, renounce it, detach from it, and then when that period is over, you can either pick it up again or you've learned to separate yourself from it. Ramadan is so extreme. You give up food, certain kinds of food, for periods of time. So we have the idea that we can build this power of renunciation and detachment with practice. We're just so overly fortunate where we find ourselves on the globe that we rarely want to give anything up or want to give it a try. But take a day, take an hour and deny yourself something, separate from something that is dear to you, and watch the results.
You know, if you go to the Catholic Encyclopedia, you will find that the real meaning of Lent is to give up something you love about yourself that you know is wrong, whatever it is. It doesn't have anything to do with physical sort of gratifications, which people have changed it to, because it's much easier to give up chocolate than to give up criticism. It's terrible how we have tainted everything with our childlike wish to escape. But what we fail to realize is, because we are spiritual beings, there is no escape. No matter how much you have done or do that is wrong or ignorant or terrible, you remain a spiritual being with the power and the necessity of fixing the wrong that you have done. And life will keep putting you into situations until you wake up and realize, I can fly.
Get it right. You had your hand up?
Can I respond?
Oh.
Just real quickly. agreed to what was said, but then doesn't that self-discipline begin on this plane? Don't we start that awareness of the inner by working here and renouncing and developing self-discipline on this plane?
But where else are we? I mean, wherever we are here. We are here when we're in the dreaming state. We are here when we're awake. We are here when we're in the after-death states. We can't cease being conscious. The problem is, while we're here in this physical plane with these contrasts, I'm not your body, I'm not your body, I'm this body, I have to worry about me. While we do that here, we shut off the reality of that communication that really is there. So while our here is this, we deny ourselves the reality. Our spiritual reality at all times is present.
But isn't the reality that we are evolving from within outward? So the ideas that we bring forward will change the manifested world around us. Unfortunately, we think it should be tomorrow. But by just holding these ideas, we are changing the world because we are not, we are no longer thinking in the same way we thought 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Well, we are changing the world in terms of the seed of future growth. Everything is on the basis of thought. And the way we think and the way we feel colors and impresses all of the life in us and around us. It is the basis of the expression, give me a few hundred who will think along higher lines and we will change the world. That would happen more quickly. This is going to take time.
We can only, as was said, we can only do what we can here. But as long as we try, even if it's just a little thing, and we've talked about in some of the meetings about if you do something nice for somebody, to see how that plays forward. Whereas the same, if you're nasty or mean to somebody, that will go forward as well. So just taking little steps about saying hello, thank you, please, to people can make a change.
The point being is that if we renounce, we can't renounce on the outer plane, on this physical plane, like denying ourselves certain things. When in our mind we are chafing and in turmoil, that we really need to renounce on the mental plane first, and it will find its platform in the physical plane. But if we do it the other way around, at some point it just turns on us. We're back where we started from, because we didn't renounce.
Actually, we're worse than we started, because we weaken our own will. If we say we will do something and then we don't do it, we've harmed ourselves a little. So we have to be careful. Our intentions and our behavior are serious responsibilities.
And if we give up something physically, we say, well, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to eat this, and as was said, our mind is still thinking about it, then we're still attached to it, that we haven't detached from it, that it is still there, especially if we keep thinking about how much I would like to have this thing that I supposedly have given up.
Yes.
Well, finally, then, simply stated, we just simply do not know who and what we are and why we're here.
That's why we are students of theosophy. That's why we turn to the higher ideas to fill our minds with that. You're not going to end with a quote from Frankl? I'm shocked.
Oh, I can. I have a wonderful. I have a wonderful one too. Love is the only way to grasp another human being in the innermost core of his personality. No one can become fully aware of the very essence of another human being unless he loves him. By his love, he is enabled to see the essential traits and features in the beloved person, and even more, he sees that which is potential in him, which is not yet actualized, but yet ought to be actualized. Furthermore, by his love, the loving person enables the beloved person to actualize these potentialities by making him aware of what he can be and of what he should become. He makes these potentialities come through. Thank you. The meeting's over.